You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about the popularity of the steampunk movement here in the state.
First, for almost 2 years, there have been concerns raised about how Hillary Clinton handled her emails during her tenure as Secretary of State. There have been questions about whether her use of a private email server was legal and whether it was secure.
Apart from worries about how she was using technology to communicate, there were also concerns and accusations about the content of those emails. Topics of interest have included what actually happened when the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya was attacked, to whether there were improper relationships and communications between staffers in the State Department and employees of the Clinton Foundation.
Joining us now to talk about that issue is Josh Gerstein. He's a senior reporter at Politico and has been following the story closely. Josh, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica and Rob. Good to be back with you.
Well, it seems like if you trace this story back far enough, it seems to begin with Hillary Clinton and her attachment to her BlackBerry. Is that where you see it all originating?
Yeah. She has never been particularly tech savvy or computer savvy. And when she came in as Secretary of State, she had not really used email except on a BlackBerry. She had done it that way when she was a senator before she became Secretary of State, done it the same way when she was both a senator and a presidential candidate in 2008. And she wanted to basically keep the same system. The problem she ran into several problems, but the key one was probably the fact that the State Department had a general policy of not allowing those types of devices in the Secretary's suite at the State Department for cybersecurity reasons, due to concerns about espionage and hacking, and the fact that there is technology that, you know, someone can remotely turn on the microphone on a phone, for example. And so they had instituted a ban. It may have not always been strictly enforced, but there had been a ban at the State Department on these types of devices. And she and her staff started sort of trying to muddle through how they could replicate this system and keep her some kind of access. And the answer that ended up eventually was to put her on a private server that was run out of her family's home in Chappaqua, New York. In retrospect, she said that was a mistake, but that's kind of how the whole thing got started.
Who was aware of that private email server out of her home when she was Secretary of State?
Well, I mean, I think probably only her close staff were aware of the server, the fact that, you know, the email was actually being stored at her home. The computer technicians, some of them knew about it. A lot more people knew that she had a private email address, that she had this ClintonEmail.com domain. There were a couple hundred people who were in correspondence with her over that four-year period. They knew that they were not writing her at state.gov, which is where you write most State Department employees. In fact, a lot of the emails that she got were coming from people at state.gov, were being sent to other people at state.gov, and she was added in with this, you know, different email address. So those folks were aware that she had a private setup of some sort. I don't imagine most of them knew whether it was stored at her home or somewhere in the State Department or at Google or something like that.
Is there any precedent for anybody else using a private server like that, someone with the kind of access and clearance that then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had?
A little bit. There's a little bit of precedent in the sense that, for example, Secretary of State Colin Powell used an AOL account. There's no real precedent that I'm aware of for that kind of a job, for somebody using their own server for all of their or official email. But there are people that have used their private accounts for work purposes. Colin Powell did as well. One of the complexities in sort of judging what Clinton did is that the amount of use people make of email over time has obviously, you know, gone up exponentially. And so when you look back to what a Secretary of State might have done 20 years ago or 30 years ago, or even in Colin Powell's era, it was just a different thing at the time. I think it was seen as an amusement and some sort of tool from the future. It wasn't sort of the meat and potatoes of the way people communicate as it is currently.
Talking with Josh Gerstein right now, senior reporter at Politico, joining us to talk about the ongoing issue of Hillary Clinton's emails during her time as Secretary of State. And we'll fast forward now. We're 3 months out from the general election, and there are still these lingering questions about some of these emails and now new concerns as well. Looking at expressly here a connection, possibly an alleged connection between State Department employees and staffers for the Clinton Foundation and donors for the Clinton Foundation. What's the latest there?
Well, you know, this whole situation has been a gift that keeps on giving for conservative groups and Republican groups that have been trying to comb up everything they can. While the emails that Clinton provided to the State Department have been made public already, there have also been efforts to get her aides' emails. So at least one of her aides used that same Clinton email server for some of her traffic. Others used their private accounts, and there are lawsuits underway to try to free up and make public some of those documents. And one set of these records that came out recently, there were a few emails from a fellow who has been a top aide to President Bill Clinton for a couple years, was his so-called body man in his last several years at the White House, a guy by the name of Doug Band. And he had a joint post with President Clinton and at the Clinton Foundation, and he was in talks with an email communication with some of Hillary Clinton's top aides, trying to connect a big donor for the foundation to a policy person, an ambassador at the State Department, trying to suggest an individual that had done advance work for a job at the State Department. And questions have been raised by critics, by Republicans about and some in the media about whether this comported with what Hillary Clinton said when she became Secretary of State, which was that she would try to sort of insulate the State Department from the Clinton Foundation. I don't think it technically violated the literal terms of the various ethics agreements that were signed, but Clinton did leave the impression with people that this was going to be sort of an arm's length arrangement, and so I think it did cause a little bit of surprise maybe to some folks, or that some people from the Clinton Foundation remained in close contact with Clinton's aides right through her term as Secretary of State.
How serious would you say these latest allegations are? Are they something that stands out to you, or are they more in keeping with the steady trickle of difficult news for her over the past several years?
I don't think they're startlingly different. I mean, folks that were concerned about these issues, that there were potential conflicts of interest, say, involving donors and policies that the State Department may have decided to pursue or not pursue, that people might have given, or foreign governments even might have given to the Clinton Foundation as a way to try to influence Secretary Clinton. I think if people were concerned about that, this is just sort of cumulative evidence there. Those people already had those kinds of concerns. And for the people that think that the Clinton Foundation was basically doing good around the world and are not terribly concerned about where the funds are coming from, I don't think this is going to change a lot of minds. So I would say that most of them are incremental, but it does seem serve as sort of that nagging reminder of how this email mess does seem to have tarnished Hillary Clinton. I think even some of her supporters, regard her less favorably as a result of what's come out here, of the sense that there's some feeling that maybe there was something tawdry surrounding the Clinton Foundation and how it raised money and how people involved with it discharged themselves while Clinton was Secretary of State.
And the news may not be over yet. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has also said WikiLeaks has emails that he thinks will damage her chances in the presidential election. Do you think he has something that could be credibly damaging?
Again, I'm inclined to think that it's probably going to be more in the cumulative and incremental kind of category. Some of the information we've seen come out through WikiLeaks and other leaking entities in recent weeks has caused great deal of consternation within the Democratic Party, but it hasn't yet done any damage, I think, to Hillary Clinton directly. The stuff that I think has been of most interest has frankly been the stuff that's coming out through the legal process under the Freedom of Information Act. We'll see what people may have released to Julian Assange and his group. There has been talk that the FBI showed at least some interest in investigating aspects of the Clinton Foundation and its fundraising, but the Justice Department decided not to go forward with that kind of probe. I suppose if Julian Assange has some information that indicates what facts it was that the FBI wanted to explore further, that could potentially be a problem for Clinton. But again, I wonder who the voters are that are likely to be pushed, you know, sort of one way or another, who might be on the fence between Clinton and Trump. It doesn't seem very likely to me at this point.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, anytime. Thank you.
That was Josh Gerstein, senior reporter at Politico, joining us to talk about the ongoing issue of Hillary Clinton's emails during her time as Secretary of State. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a guest makes the case that a change in property rights could help lift many Native Americans out of poverty.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Mixing the Victorian age with technology and industry, steampunk has taken off in recent years in places you might expect, like Madison and Milwaukee, but also in Lodi, where I went to meet Anita Peterson.
Famously, steampunk avoids a very good definition, and that's part of its charm, is that every single person who does it or sees it has a different definition, and we like it that way. And generally, steampunk is considered to be a Victorian period. So if you were living back in that period, but were thinking futuristically, say like Jules Verne, and you were thinking about going to the moon, well, your major source of power was steam, was coal, or horsepower, like actual horsepower. How would you get to the moon? I would say that it is looking at the past, looking at the future. I've always been pretty creative, but when steampunk came along, it just opened everything up. Because I could then make things that no one had ever thought of before. What was really nice about, that I like about steampunk, or really any crafting for that matter, is it invites you to learn new things. I have had to learn so many things. In fact, I'm taking a welding class later on today, so I can learn how to make even bigger things. And that's the impetus for it. I love to make. That's the point for me. Some people get into steampunk, it's all about the persona, it's all about role-playing, and that's great. For me, though, it's a vehicle. It's a vehicle for figuring out what my outfit's going to be, what kind of accessories I need. One of my personae is a cartographer, because that year, TeslaCon, we were going to the moon. So I was a lunar cartographer. And that meant, ooh, I get to wear an astrolabe, and I have this brass compass, and I have a map tube on my back, and I have my quill. I'm all ready to map the moon. So in the vein of role-playing, but not quite, you'll have steampunk events. And we've had a couple here, a lawn party, which was great. People came, they dressed up in their steampunk outfits, and we played lawn games, and we had entertainments. Now, these aren't reenactments. A lot of people who do steampunk, they know that the Victorian era, for most people, was pretty bad. All those things. You didn't have workers' protections. Racism was like a bedrock of the society. Classicism was terrible. Women couldn't do anything. All that stuff. But what's fun is when you take that and switch it around to kind of show up the things that were bad about then and the things that are good about now. When you have a person, say, who's African American, and their persona is as, you know, this fantastic duke. Steampunks, they tend to be in the southern part of the state. Madison has a big one. Milwaukee has a big one. And then there are smaller ones. Lodi is probably one of the most successful smaller ones, only because we just keep on doing things. Actually, a lot of them like to do steampunk invasions, which is where we all dress up in our finery and we go somewhere, a restaurant, a museum. There was an event where we went shopping, antiquing in Milton, and there were 14 of us looking, you know, crazy. People love it.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Staying in the steampunk world, we're joined now by Eric Larson, who is in the Wisconsin steampunk community. He's better known there as Lord Hastings Robert Bobbins III. He's the chairman of the graphic design program at Madison Media Institute and also founder of TeslaCon. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, as we just heard, Eric, steampunk is hard to pin down with an exact definition, but for someone who's never encountered it, how would you describe it?
It's the one question I'm asked most often and the one question that can change most often. I've seen examples where it's a three-page, what is it? And I've heard the meme, or seen the meme, I should say, on Facebook that says, just tell them it's the Wild Wild West and everyone will get it. It's basically, I guess it's, to me, what it is, it's not reenacting as like a Civil War or World War II type of thing, but it's reenacting the Victorian age in sort of a sci-fi manner. If you were to think about what would happen if we had technology that was 50, 80 years ahead of where they were, but it was done with steam, pistons, cogs and gears, lots of oil, very much, I almost want to say Chitty Chitty Bang Bang kind of creation. That's steampunk at its essence. It's makers creating things, building things that never happened, but look real, feel real, and act as though it's a normal thing. So, yes, you could have an automaton. You don't have a robot, but you have an automaton that uses punch cards to go get your breakfast every morning. And that's what it basically is. People either writing, creating, drawing, sewing, or, quote, making items that could fit in this type of world. And then we all get together and show them off, basically.
How big is the steampunk community in Wisconsin?
Well, my belief would be Milwaukee has probably at least 75 to 125 members on and off, depending. Madison probably has a good 75 people. If you take the surrounding areas, probably about 100, 125 also. And then you have places like Lodi. There are smaller groups up in La Crosse, probably 20 to 30 people. Northeastern Wisconsin by Green Bay and up there, there's about 20 or so. And then they're sort of scattered all through. I would say, to be on the safe side, probably a good 400 to 500 people statewide are really into it. But with my convention, we get people from around the world. So I can't, and we get them from every state. So it's hard to say it's just a local thing because we pull people in from everywhere. We've had every state represented and at least 28 different countries now. So it's okay here. Out east on the eastern seaboard, it's huge, gigantic.
And Eric, you mentioned TeslaCon, the convention you founded. What happens if the uninitiated walked in? What would they see? What kind of events would be going on?
Well, it's not a normal convention. I worked on the Star Wars movie for 4 years, the re-releases in licensing and advertising, and I worked with Disney and Warner Brothers, so I got to meet a lot of people. And one of the things I decided was if we do something like this, we have to, my partner in this, Brian, we both decided we have to do something different. We're not just going to have people come and sit in panels and then walk out. It has to be more entertaining. So if you take a bit of the Renaissance Fair attribute, which is the immersion part, and we do that with steampunk characters, and we put that into a convention, but we add all types of things. We add the fashion show. This year we're doing dirigible racing. We're doing splendid teapot racing, which where people redesign RC cars with teapots on them, and you have to go through these maneuvers. We're going to be having Evil Minion Olympics, which is and it's for all the bad guys, and we have our bad guys and our good guys. The fun thing about it is, for me, two of my characters, we created Practicus, who's our Dr. Practicus, is the evil guy with the twirly mustache and that, and Captain Reinhard Krieger, who's like my captain of all my ill-fated ships. They both were voted favorite characters a couple years ago in one of the steampunk papers. So our actual characters are now known just as much as the convention, which I think is sort of funny. But they all have their followings.
And yours, you're one of these characters of the following,
and I never planned to be. I just planned to run the convention, sort of be the hi, here I am at the beginning, hi, here I am at the end. And I've been sucked into it. And, you know, I have to, I am the bumbling, kind-hearted Prime Minister of England at this point, who I sort of take it off a little off Colonel Crittenton from Hogan's Heroes and a couple other really ill-fated, really bad stereotypical Englishmen who talk like this. Oh, good Lord. Oh, my. I need tea immediately. You know, like that. And I'm always befuddled because if something is horrible, the only thing that can save me is Earl Grey. So, and people like it. I mean, they get a kick out of it. There's a running gag where the captain never is allowed strawberry ice cream. And I'm always, you know, I have strawberry ice cream. And it's like, you do? But you can't have any. Oh, you know, and then he'll pout, and then the audience laughs. And we're doing a lot of, we're getting more into sight gigs. This year we go to Paris, which is sort of fun. So the whole theme is Paris in 1886. We're having a scientific exhibition, and so we're going to have makers show their evil wares, their good wares. It's fun. And then all kinds of stuff that's French in theme. And each of the years is, I plan everything out 3 years in advance, but the first year was just a general, we're in a dirigible. Second one, 20,000 Leagues Under the Ether. We did A Journey to the Moon. We've done the Congress of Steam. That's about the largest one we had. That was about 1,615 people. So it was a lot of people from around the world came to that one. We did Journey to the Center of the Earth with dinosaurs. We did the Old West, and now we're doing France, because why not?
And Eric, before we let you go, I got to ask, if I show up at one of these things and I'm not wearing, you know, goggles or monocles or some kind of costume, am I going to look like an idiot?
No. Just to let everybody know, we do have the biggest dealer's room of any convention, and they carry everything. So if you wanted to buy something, the best way I can describe it to people really quick, you wear like a white Oxford shirt, black or tan pants, and a vest. If you can do that, you'll probably fit in pretty good. We're not going to tell anyone to leave if they aren't dressed up. We never have. But it's easy.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Well, you're welcome. And if anyone's interested in TeslaCon, it's just TeslaCon.com. So thank you so much.
That was Eric Larson, founder of TeslaCon. We've been talking about the steampunk community in Wisconsin.
Coming up, we talk to a writer who says one of the ways to fix poverty and inequities in Native American communities is by giving more property rights to people living on reservations. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Stand back.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7, it's Reveal. Reporter Tennessee Watson was sexually abused by her gymnastics coach when she was a kid. Over 25 years later, when she learned he was still coaching children, she called the police. Her inside account of seeking justice in her own case spotlights a lack of accountability. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, for years, many people's understanding of Native Americans has been through maybe the stories they studied in grade school American history classes. Those are stories that might have focused on the first Thanksgiving, smallpox, the French and Indian War, or the Trail of Tears.
A new book is taking a closer look at the plight of Native American communities today. Right now, Native Americans have the highest rates of poverty of any racial group, have youth that are affected by gang violence more than other groups, and also struggle with suicide as a leading cause of death among Native American men.
Our next guest says the cause of these problems facing Native American communities isn't in the stories we were told in school necessarily, but in the federal government's policies today. Joining us now is Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's a weekly columnist for the New York Post and a former Wall Street Journal editor. Her most recent book, The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians, is out now. Naomi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, one of your overarching points in the book is to understand the problems of Native Americans today. Don't so much focus on the history. Look at federal government policy today. Why is that a better starting point?
Well, I think there's no denying that this history of war and forced assimilation has had a tremendous effect on these communities. But I think most people don't really understand what it means that Native Americans today are living on reservations. They don't even really understand what a reservation is. So I try to start there. A reservation means that the land is held in trust by the federal government. Originally, of course, these policies were put in place to push Native Americans out of the way so we could pursue our manifest destiny. But now, actually, the policies are preventing Native Americans from exercising economic freedom. And what I mean by that is that Native Americans don't actually own reservation land. The fact that it's held in trust by the federal government means that they can't buy it and sell it among themselves without the approval of a staff member at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. It means that if an American Indian wanted to go to the bank and get a mortgage to purchase a house, he could not do that because the bank would say you don't have the underlying title to the land. And of course, many Americans also use their home and their property as equity to start small businesses. And Native Americans don't have access to that capital either because they don't, again, technically own the land.
Right, and that's, you've gone right to the core of your argument, I think, that the way that reservation land is owned hurts economic prosperity or prevents economic prosperity for Native Americans. Can you spell out a little more how big the damage is as you see it?
Sure. So, I mean, let's just start with the first part. You know, like I went to, for instance, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Montana, and I spoke with a man there who simply wanted to purchase some land from a neighbor in order to graze some cattle that he owned on a larger piece of property. And he and his neighbor agreed on a price. And a member of the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in and said, no, we don't think that's fair market value for the land. Now, of course, for most Americans, fair market value is what someone will pay you for the land, not an artificial price that the federal government sets. But it's even sort of more ironic than that in the sense that the federal government had just surveyed the land for some other purpose, and they had specifically told the surveyor to boost the price so as, quote, to not screw the Indians. So, of course, in the end, neither the buyer nor the seller got what they wanted. But I want to also focus on this question of not being able to get a mortgage because it's hugely important. There is a severe housing shortage on these reservations. Now, of course, if you live in New York City, you know, a housing shortage means to you that there just aren't enough apartments and there's not enough space. But the notion that on these reservations, which sometimes run to millions of square miles, the notion that there's not enough place to build a home is crazy. And so what you see is a lot of temporary homes, a lot of trailer homes, and people piling into homes, you know, many extended families living in tiny trailer homes. And it is just outrageous, in my opinion, that people have to live like this because, again, of the reservation policy.
So is it impossible to buy land from a Native American on a reservation, or is it just prohibitively difficult given regulations that you were touching on?
Well, Native Americans can try to exchange the land among themselves, but as one tribal legislator I spoke with on the Crow Reservation said to me, we are the most overregulated race on Earth. And what he means by that is there are actually over 9,000 bureaucrats at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The name BIA, you know, which is the acronym for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, most Indians call that the bossing Indians around. That's what they think it really should stand for, and with good reason. I mean, these bureaucrats are intervening in every aspect of their lives, from the purchase of land to, you know, to food stamps, to housing policy, to health services. There's very little autonomy that we give these people. Even the language, using the phrase in trust, I think is offensive because, you know, the only people that we legally hold things in trust for are children and the mentally incompetent. So I think it's shameful in the 21st century that this is the way we talk about our Indian policy.
Talking to Naomi Schaefer Riley, her new book is called The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians. She says there need to be serious changes in the way tribal land is owned, managed, and ultimately by the federal government currently to try to turn around poverty in Native American communities. Naomi, you point toward a couple of arguments that you think are at least not the whole story or maybe red herrings in this conversation. One solution pointed to is that the federal government should give more money to reservation communities.
Right. So there's, no doubt that we have, have treaties and agreements where we say, we will provide education and health care as a federal government to Indian communities. And we have done an absolutely abysmal job of this, despite sending billions upon billions of dollars each year to these communities. American Indians have some of the worst public schools in the country. They have a 50% graduation rate. And I visited some of these schools, and it is absolutely appalling what goes on there. I was taken around one school by a principal. She took me to a math class where she offered to answer the questions of some second graders, and she actually got the math problems that the second graders were doing incorrect. She has fired teachers there who came from Teach for America because she basically found that she thought they were sort of too paternalistic for her, but many of the teachers are completely incompetent, and it's not surprising. The result of the fact that there is no private sector on these reservations, that there is no private sector employment, is that public sector jobs become hugely important. They are the most sought-after jobs. So if you want to be the fourth grade teacher and your uncle or your cousin happens to be on the tribal council and you want that job, it doesn't matter if you're qualified. They will give you that job. And so you can see how this has completely, I think, undermined the quality. And no amount of money from Washington is going to change that. Similarly, the Indian Health Services is a place that no one would want to go as their first option or even their last option as a place to get health care. We have poured billions upon billions of dollars into this. We obviously need to help, I think, Indian communities come up with better solutions. I'm not saying we need to turn off sending public funds to them, but for instance, South Dakota and actually a number of the states that have the largest Indian communities actually have no charter school laws. So for instance, there are no alternative schools in most of these reservations, and they really don't have any options for their children.
You also say the focus on some cultural issues, Native American stereotypes for sports teams, that kind of thing, isn't a primary concern for the people you talk to.
It absolutely isn't. I mean, I went to a variety of Indian communities across the country, and I was hard-pressed to find somebody who thought about changing team names or mascots as a priority in addressing the needs of their community. And as you can see from a recent Washington Post poll that suggested that 9 out of 10 or more than 9 out of 10 American Indians said they didn't really care about the name Redskins for the Washington football team. And that's not really surprising. As you pointed out at the beginning of the program, this is a community where suicide is the leading cause of death for boys ages 10 to 14. So the notion that things like sport team names are going to severely affect their outcomes is, I think, absurd and in some ways fairly offensive. I also think that this, you hear, people say, well, isn't this affecting, their psychology? For kids who are growing up on these reservations in poverty with few educational options, poor health services, disintegrating families, I really think we need to put sports teams at the bottom of the list.
Dr. Naomi Schaefer Riley, she's the author of the new book, The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a member of a Native American tribe here in Wisconsin? How important do you think property rights are? And do you think that life for Native Americans would change if people on reservations were given property rights? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll be back with this conversation here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's a weekly columnist for the New York Post. Her new book is The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or posting on the Central Time Facebook page, where we've also posted an article by our guest. Tell us what you think we should be focusing on in the national conversation about Native American communities. And do you think we should be paying more attention to federal policy toward Native American tribes? Call 800-642-1234.
And Naomi, before we get to our callers, what would it look like if we changed the way property ownership works? What would change on a reservation?
Well, it's interesting. Our neighbors to the north are actually a little bit ahead of us in this, as with perhaps some other things. They actually have a very similar system in Canada called the reserve system instead of the reservation system. And a group of First Nations in British Columbia have actually put together something called the First Nations Property Ownership Act, which I think could serve as a really interesting template for the United States. Right now it's being considered in Parliament. And what they have done there is they've said this is a program that reserves can opt into. That is, if you don't think property rights are a good idea for your community, you don't have to accept them. But these leaders of these First Nations that I interviewed said the way it would work is that First Nations would retain control over the land, but individuals would be able to buy and sell their land either to other members of First Nations or to non-members if they wanted to. But similarly, you know, with, say, the city of Boston or the city of New York, even if the land is bought and sold among individuals, the underlying title still remains part of the city of Boston or part of the city of New York and is governed accordingly.
We'll go to our callers now with Joan in Superior. Joan, hi.
Hi. I certainly agree with what the speaker has to say about tribal land and the way that it's fractionated. I do have some contention, though, regarding Indian health care and education. I live in Superior. I work and I'm enrolled in a band in Minnesota, Fond du Lac, and we have excellent health care, two clinics, eye doctors, dentists, all kinds of medical, physical therapy, mental health. I've been a school board member on the tribal, for our tribal school. All our teachers are licensed. They all have four-year degrees. They're licensed to the state of Minnesota. And the speaker made it sound like, you know, we just had wacky people that were the daughter of the tribal council member because they wanted to be teachers. I mean, everybody has to be a licensed teacher with a four-year degree and a valid teacher's license.
Joan, thanks for the call. Naomi, are things different from reservation to reservation?
Certainly they are different from reservation to reservation. And, you know, in part it depends on the availability of other employment nearby. So, you know, if you have other private sector opportunities, I think those public sector jobs become less of the subject of, you know, nepotism and corruption. But if you are, I visited the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is one of the largest and poorest reservations in the United States and South Dakota, and it's really quite isolated. And essentially in reservations like that, that are a little further out west, you know, you're waiting for someone to die to get a job. I mean, unemployment rates top 80% on some of these reservations. So there is a great deal of variation from reservation to reservation, but I do think that we need to focus in terms of changing policy on the reservations and the Indians who are most vulnerable at this point. I mean, one thing people often ask me is, why don't American Indians leave the reservations? And many of them do. I mean, there are about a million people living still on reservations, but the people who are left behind are unfortunately some of the most poor and the most vulnerable and the most uneducated. And those are the people I think that we need to worry about in terms of changing policies.
Time for one more caller with Ben in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. I have lived and worked on the Leech Lake Nation for a number of years. I have an issue with the idea of breaking it down to property. The Red Lake Nation does not parcel up their land, and it's all in the hands of the nation. And Red Lake has the highest rate of cultural retention, religious contention, linguistic retention of all the Ojibwe nations. Where Leech Lake, about 3% of Leech Lake is in Native hands because most of it's been bought up as a vacation community by white people. And I think that parceling up land would further degrade the cultural integrity of these tribes.
Ben,
and
thanks for the call. I want to give our guest time to respond. The idea that if you parcel out the land, break up the land, you're breaking up more than that. You're breaking up maybe the culture, the cultural cohesion, Naomi.
Well, I guess I'm confused because it sounded like your caller was saying that they had the most cultural cohesion, but that the land had already
been broken up. He's comparing two different ones.
I misunderstood. In general, cultural cohesion is most visible among tribes where they have the most wealth. And that's actually true across not just American Indians, but across other communities in the United States. You can see how immigrant communities that have done well have actually been the most able to retain their language, to retain their culture over time. So I think say to those people who are concerned about retaining culture and language, you know, you have to get past the point where you're worrying about your daily basic survival, and then you can worry about things like retaining culture and language.
Naomi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's a weekly columnist for the New York Post and a former Wall Street Journal editor. We've been talking to her about her most recent book. It's called The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians. You can read an article drawn from the book. We've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts. And if you're a member of a tribe or have lived close to a reservation, let us know your experiences there as well. Again, that's at the Central Time Facebook page.
Women make up almost half the labor force, but they represent just over a quarter of workers in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM fields. As Danielle Kading reports, educators at UW-Superior held a girls' space camp this month to encourage their involvement in careers that have been dominated by men.
What do you want me to do?
You want to do it?
Like pull it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just hold here.
10 girls are getting ready to blast off their homemade rockets on the UW-Superior campus. They crafted them out of 2-liter pop bottles, filling them partway with water. One by one, they rest them carefully on a network of PVC pipe and fill them with air from a tire pump until they shoot skyward. Superior's Maggie Sangenberger says she took part in the space camp because she wants a career in astronomy or engineering, anything related to science.
It hasn't stayed the same for the past 20 years, and it won't stay the same for the next 20 years because it's always changing. It's full of discoveries and just moving forwards instead of just staying in one place. Like, it wouldn't be boring to go to work every day.
UW-Superior Transportation and Logistics Professor Richard Stewart says they started a girls-only space camp this year to encourage and empower young women to learn and expand in STEM careers.
The fact is that for a long time, legislatively, we prohibited women from being involved in many of these fields. Up until the mid-70s, you couldn't sail aboard a ship as a woman. It was prohibited by law in becoming a woman officer.
The space camp was supported by a $5,000 award from the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium. Program manager Christine Thompson says the consortium is focused on getting kids excited about aerospace and other science fields.
It comes back to, how are we inspiring them? How are we equipping them? How are we empowering them and encouraging them to explore how they can be involved in one of those fields?
Deluce Eminitali says the camp is a place where she doesn't have to worry about being teased by the boys at her school.
They usually say, you're just a girl, you can't do any of this, and then usually I get like a better score on a test than them or complete a worksheet faster.
During a recent visit to UWS for a space conference, Alice Bowman said girls like Natali should stick with what they love through whatever hurdles they face. Bowman is the first woman operations manager for the New Horizons mission to explore Pluto at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory.
You need to understand that some of these STEM careers are challenging, but there are a lot of people around you that are willing to help you out. There's one or two classes that may not go as well as you think they should, but I would say stick with it because the payoff is huge. If you can have a job that you really love, it's fantastic. At least it's worked out for me.
A bill was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives this year that would require the National Science Foundation to support activities to expose more women and minorities to STEM fields. As for Maggie Sangenberger, she says she likes the idea of more programs like the Girls' Space Camp,
where it's just focusing on them and helping them become more confident in what they want to do instead of keeping them with everybody else and not really showing them all these careers and stuff that they could do.
Sangenberger says if they're not exposed to STEM fields, they'll never know what they might be missing out on. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.